What is the spider chain? This is one of those things you might have heard if you've been traversing the new Bitcoin L2 space, and certain names will pop up more consistently than others. And the spider chain, which is something made by Botanix Labs, which is an L2, it's EVM, so it uses the ETH virtual machine. But the spider chain is their way of solving the peg in, peg out process. And so I kept hearing about it, didn't know enough, had to get on the best person to talk about exactly that, the co-founder, Willem Schro. So that's what we're doing. Real quick though, welcome back to Built on Bitcoin. I'm your humble host, Jacob Brown. You know what we do here. We're talking to the best founders in Bitcoin. We're creating all the best shit on Bitcoin. So, as I mentioned, today we have Willem on the show. He's the co-founder of Botanix, and most of this is about the spider chain. We touch a little bit on his background. He's a math wizard, but I was really curious because out of this new L2 space, there's a lot of overlapping designs. They're very similar. It's hard to understand where these things are actually different, and Botanix is taking a different design with this thing called the spider chain, which is like a train of decentralized multi-sigs is one way to think about it. And so we touch really this whole episode on the nuances of how this thing exactly works. So if you're curious about that, this is the perfect episode for you. So without further ado, let's jump into this conversation with Willem Schro, the co-founder of Botanix.
Welcome to Built on Bitcoin.
Willem, how you doing today, my man?
I'm doing good. How are you? Good to be here.
I am fantastic. Good to have you, man. Good to have you. We're just gonna jump right in. We're talking L2s. You guys are building one, and Bitcoin. But real quick, because I know a little bit about you, but not a ton. It sounds like you have a background in like commodities and kind of like the energy space, maybe. And then you have a strong cryptography background, but now you're in Bitcoin. So like, give me the 60-second TLDR of like what you did in the past life and how you ended up on Bitcoin.
No, it sounds perfect. I grew up in Belgium, so Belgium for most of my life, actually. There's a lot of big cryptographers, actually, in Belgium, and in Bitcoin as well. Then I became a 13th national championship in mathematics, so I was good in mathematics. Then ended up doing electrical engineering, then started researching in cryptography. So I researched in authenticated encryption. It's basically the cryptography where you want to bring together both authentication and encryption in one single algorithm, which is extremely hard, by the way. So researching that, broke some algorithms in there. Actually saw Bitcoin in my cryptography classes already there. Then ended up working in chemicals, so something totally different. That brought me to Saudi Arabia, so I lived 2 years in Saudi. Then went to Harvard in Boston, and then to New York. And yeah, basically saw Bitcoin in my cryptography classes, only put together later the bigger macro picture. And basically 2 years ago, came up with the idea for Botanix, which is like, I think, one of the first two, actually, of the Bitcoin layer twos before there was like the hundreds of them. And the theory there is like still exactly the same. I think Bitcoin is a winning money. I think the EVM is the winning virtual machine. And then, I wanted to build a layer 2 EVM on Bitcoin. First, actually started off wanting to build rollups on Bitcoin. Realized the different downsides that come along with rollups. And so I went deep into the cryptography. I love decentralization. I'm a decentralization maxi. And so designed what's now called the spider chain.
Very cool. Actually, I would love to get your definition real quick, because I've been pushing on people to define decentralization, and it seems like the community at large, especially the average kind of like DeFi user, which will often comment on these things, they seem to conflate decentralization and trustlessness as like one and the same. And I'm trying to parse where those things start and stop. It seems like they do overlap at some level. But, like, how do you define decentralization? And, like, maybe if it helps to bracket against trustlessness.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. A lot of people call, it comes from DeFi, right? And it's decentralized finance. But in reality, it's not decentralized. It's trustless. Basically, if you have an immutable smart contract, that's not really decentralized. It's a fully trustless smart contract, really, because you cannot change the code there. And so, yeah, where I put the decentralization is if a single party, and I often think about governments, because that's where we need to protect ourselves from, like, longer term. What if a government subpoena a certain company? What can they achieve? And if the protocol is not able to protect themselves against it, I would call it quite centralized. And so there is quite a big spectrum, I think, in terms of what you would need for certain applications, right? I think if you want to be the best money out there for the next thousands of years, you need to be extremely decentralized, which brings you to Bitcoin, extremely decentralized. Now, if you want to go beyond that and basically maybe make like an NFT marketplace, how decentralized does that actually have to be, right? And so you suddenly come into this spectrum. I think why I'm building the Spider Chain, for example, is because I believe the financial system that we're building, like with DeFi, and that you've seen already the primitives on Ethereum, I think that needs to be decentralized. I think the financial system cannot run on a central roll-up. You don't want one country in the world to basically rule the financial system. Ideally, this is open, permissionless for anyone in the world. And so that means you need to have at least a few thousand nodes that basically control the whole system. And you cannot have like 10 or 5 or even 15. And that's a little bit what goes into like very centralized or like very decentralized. And different applications will need different that level of decentralization.
That's helpful. So, yeah, just to quickly like make sure that mental models are magic here for people. It sounds like the way to think about trustlessness is kind of a pass-fail. It's a yes or no, or a boolean in programming. So it's either trustless or it's not. Decentralization, though, is there's no central point of failure, no central point of like entity of control, but it's a spectrum. And so like 10 people, kind of decentralized, 1,000, much more. But I think what people also get messed up is that if something has 10x the people that are contributing, is it 10x more secure? It kind of has like a fall off is what seems to be implied. So I want to make sure, like, does that track correctly?
Correct. Exactly. Yeah.
Okay, cool. Sounds good. I think we can go deeper. And so 2 years ago, you have this idea. And back then, there was no L2 season yet. Like Bitcoin L2s, there was only a few of them. It definitely wasn't cool to build here yet. Like L1 and Lightning were still like the darlings. And so yeah, talk to me about like the initial idea to build a scaling solution and like what you saw as gaps in the market.
Yeah. No, I basically, I'm a big Bitcoiner. I believe this world absolutely needs Bitcoin. And I saw it, the whole crypto industry, and what I saw happening very interestingly is I saw a lot of applications reach product market fit. Actually, I still remember Michael Saylor at some point said that what made him realize that Bitcoin is not going away is because once it reached like $100 billion market cap, he said there's not a single asset or company in the world that went beyond $100 billion and then went back to zero. And so I saw the same thing happening with the applications outside of Bitcoin. You had a lot of different applications, a lot of those reach product market fit. I mean, there's billions of dollars of applications that have been made that have survived multiple cycles. They're still there. People are still using it. It solves an actual use case in the world. And so I saw that, but they were not built on Bitcoin. And I was like, okay, how does that make sense? And can we actually do that on Bitcoin? And I started seeing a difference between Ethereum, the asset, and the EVM, the virtual machine. Basically realized the EVM as virtual machine is what powers all these applications, not Ethereum, the asset. And so you can basically bring the EVM to Bitcoin. And that's what I realized. And so that's what I wanted to do. I was like, okay, but how? Then you come into the next question, of course. How the hell do you bring an EVM to Bitcoin? And can Bitcoin be the native currency on the EVM? Now, of course, we already saw Binance Chain, Avalanche, and a few others use actually, or even Optimism, use different tokens as a native asset of the EVM. So I realized you can use Bitcoin as the native asset on the EVM. So I wanted to bring EVM to Bitcoin. EVM is account model. Bitcoin is UTXO model. Makes things very, very hard because you cannot immediately map from UTXO to account model and the other way around. And so I tried to figure out how to actually do this. And of course, the most obvious solution is like roll-ups on Ethereum. And at that moment, more and more people were thinking about, can we do roll-ups on Bitcoin? I think that's still fully unclear. I don't know exactly how we're doing it. There's like this mixes with BitVM, which is like a hybrid between like an optimistic roll up with some like if you then put in a ZK verifier, so you have like a mix of different trust assumptions, quite different models than what you have on Ethereum. But wanted to bring the EVM to Bitcoin. In very short answer. Basically, I realized someone told me today what we're trying to do is the opposite of wrap Bitcoin. So wrap Bitcoin brought Bitcoin as an asset to the new tech. Right, and a new tech is like the EVM, virtual machine, smart contract applications. What we're trying to do is the opposite. We're bringing the tech, the virtual machines, the EVM, to the Bitcoin, the asset. And I think that's way more valuable.
I love it. It's striking that, especially back in 2022 when you started, and I've been here since 2021, so I'm a newish Bitcoiner, but the dominant narrative was like Bitcoin, not crypto. Time chain, not blockchain, all these things. And they were trying to artificially make them clearly separate. And a big one too was EVM is ETH. They just are the same thing. And so your kind of awareness to be able to not throw the baby out with the bathwater, be like, these things are useful, even though they are just trading, you know, poop coins most of the time, and they don't have that much utility. The fundamental structure of it can be very useful. I think is it's the dominant narrative now, or quickly becoming that, is like DeFi and Bitcoin is going to be absolutely huge. But it's like, it was contrarian for a long time.
It was very contrarian. No, believe me, I was right there. It's actually because I was at Harvard and I was the only Bitcoiner there. And I was trying to convince everyone that Bitcoin was the only thing that had value. And everyone else was trying to convince me that all the rest had value, but Bitcoin didn't. And I was like, wait, let me actually like sit down with them and like see what value do you see. And actually they kind of convinced me, like, okay, yeah, this actually has potential, this actually has a future benefit. And so you had these two camps that were like fully separate, and maybe, as funny history turns out, maybe the right answer was like right in the middle. That was the gap in the market, basically.
Yep, love it. Okay, let's start to deep dive into what you guys are actually building. And I want to bracket, we're going to talk a lot about the spider chain. So for people listening, latch onto that word. We're going to deep dive into why that's so important here soon. But first, give us the high level of what is Botanix?
As the company, so Botanix Labs is actually the company. The spider chain is a technology that we're doing. We're basically a layer 2 EVM, fully running on Bitcoin. So we're not connected to any other chains. Everything runs on Bitcoin. Bitcoin is a native currency. Gas fees are in Bitcoin, which will bring you Bitcoin yield. And we're hoping to bring all the applications of Ethereum back to Bitcoin.
There you go. Okay. And maybe first point to get clarity on L2 running on Bitcoin. And L2 is a buzzword that people want to fight over. We'll just assume it extends Bitcoin in some way. But when you say running on Bitcoin versus, if you look at rootstock, there's some similarities there. It's EVM, it's merge mined. So when you say L2 running on Bitcoin, clarify a little bit.
Yeah, depends on how deep you want to go into technology and naming. What I mean by that is that we don't have any other asset in the whole technology stack. I don't think we need another asset in there. I think Bitcoin is the pristine asset, is the best asset. We can leverage the proof of work. We're not connected to or dependent on any other chain in that sense. Like, we don't have any risk if any other chain would go down, for example.
Got it. Okay. And then, So yeah, the big innovation we want to touch on is the spider chain, because it for people to think about, the two big difficult things in Bitcoin is that you can do a side chain, which is like a different environment and maybe has different consensus mechanism, and you can do all kinds of fun stuff over there. But given Bitcoin script, you can't peg trustlessly. You can send it that way, it's totally fine. You can pick a destination address, spin it up, and you send it off. But getting it back and you controlling those funds has not been possible to date. So there's all kinds of clever designs trying to solve that peg mechanism. So I want to make sure that we have this clear. The EVM is the sidechain piece where you can do the execution and all the fun stuff. And the spider chain is this kind of bridge that connects the sidechain, if you will, and the L1. Is that correct?
Yeah, correct. So basically, just to clarify, I also think that rollups are sidechains. They run the same thing as like an EVM. They have their batches. They've got their block producers. It's just a different trust model. And the spider chain is indeed what we call the two-way bridge. I actually am very skeptical on trustlessness. I think that's a goal people want to achieve, but in my mind, it's almost impossible from a just an information theory standpoint, I think. And we haven't seen it today. I don't think there's anything today that is trustless. Even in theory, we don't have it yet.
Okay, that's we'll definitely touch back on that later, because I think it opens up a question too of like trustlessness, which typically implies like cryptography-based things and just like pure code execution. And then there's this other side of economic security, and there's a dance there. But we'll put a pin in that for now. Let's, so we'll assume, you know, and this one, go ahead.
Yeah. You want to go jump into the spider chain, right?
Yeah, exactly. So we're gonna make sure, like, the main thing on the spider chain is we're going to talk about this peg mechanism. We're going to assume once you can solve for this peg mechanism, there's like a Disneyland place where you can do all kinds of magical stuff and it just works. And so the botanic side of that, we're going to assume we have ways to think about that already. So that's cool. The peg piece is the big part that you guys are innovating on. And I think my audience has a pretty good pulse on the state of this. So like you have two of two on Lightning, you have federations, and then you're like with Stacks coming online now with the SBTC, there's like these different, or TBTC, for example, you have these like collateral-backed threshold ones. How does the spider chain fit into those current paradigms? And then let's kind of give us an overview of what the spider chain is.
Sounds good. So the spider chain is a little bit like a mix of the ones you've mentioned, and consider it more of a mix of the Lightning Network together with federations. And it's very similar, like a Fedimint is also a bunch of different federations where people can like launch their own federations. And it's a little bit similar to that. In essence, the spider chain is what they call this series of decentralized multisigs. And in essence, everything is often a multisig. And so the Lightning Network is a 2 out of 2 multisig. And so very cool, the whole Lightning Network, when you look from a very high level perspective, is this whole network of 2 out of 2 multisigs between all different people, and you call them channels. It's beautiful. And so if you park that idea, but then think bigger and you want to recreate that whole network of decentralized multisigs, that's what we're trying to do with the spider chain. And how in essence it works is like you create this series of bigger multisigs, and anyone will be able to permissionally participate. That's how you scale to like 10,000 or 100,000 nodes. And so in essence, for example, if you start with one single multisig, you will randomly choose 100 participants out of the 10,000, and they will secure one single multisig. And then you do that again, you create a new one, and you again randomly choose 100 participants out of the 10,000, and they will secure a multisig too. And then you create a third one, and then a fourth one, and a fifth one, and a sixth one. And you keep creating these like sub-federations or decentralized federations. And after a while, you have this like whole network of decentralized multisigs where anyone can participate in, where anyone can join, and where anyone can fully join in the network. And that's how you create a permissionless decentralized layer tool.
I see. Okay, so to compare it against a federation as we typically understand it, a federation is like you choose the people that are going to be part of that, and there's like a brand reputation piece there. So like on Liquid, there's, you know, it's 70 whatever entities, and you just know, okay, because they're big names, we trust them, but I can't go and join it unless I get approved by, you know, the entities that choose that. In this paradigm, anybody can join as needed and become part of that signer set. That's one of the big fundamental differences.
Yeah. So maybe let's clarify. Federation, for example, Liquid, 15 fixed, you cannot join. You can only trust that these 15 are very well chosen. I think today Liquid is a dynamic federation. So every once in a while, someone can leave, someone else can join. It's a dynamic federation. And what the Spider Chain enables is basically a permissionless protocol where anyone can join in, scalable up to like 10,000 or to 100,000.
Got it. Okay. And so anybody running... Go ahead.
It's more a network, actually, than a federation.
Got it. And every person part of that network is also running a Bitcoin node and a Botanix node?
Correct. So you will both run Botanix node, the EVM. You run the Spider chain, basically tracking all of these different or network of multisigs, and you run a Bitcoin node. So it's a little bit heavier. It's more or less hardware requirements like Ethereum. So way more heavier. It's not really designed for every person to run a node in the world, even though you can. But it's more designed like an Ethereum, where every company in the world can run a node. And then that's how I think how it should be. Basically, how I think you scale Bitcoin is Bitcoin on the base layer can be run by every person in the world. And that's absolutely needed. For a second layer, for a financial system, doesn't make sense that every person in the world needs to run that. But every company in the world can run that. So we'll be more like an Ethereum, where anyone can join. But the hardware requirements and the staking requirements are that high that it's more suited for like institutions and companies in the world to run that.
Okay. And to join the network, I run these two nodes, and then I'm just locking up BTC, or what's that process look like?
Correct. So you will lock up BTC. So you signal to the rest of the network, look, I want to join as a full node, as a staker. Basically, I guess when we haven't mentioned all these 10,000 nodes, you come together in a proof of stake. So each one of those stakes Bitcoin, and that secures the EVM. So if you want to join as a full node, you basically stake Bitcoin, and then you get recognized by the rest of the network, and you will get accepted.
Okay, and is there a minimum for that? How do you pick like being eligible to be elected like part of the network?
Yeah, there will be a fixed staking amount. What we're playing around with right now is thinking about 5 Bitcoin. Basically, that goes into the security model of the Spider chain, which is actually quite unique. It operates as an over-collateralized bridge, but it's actually under-collateralized. You don't need the full collateralization. And that's a big breakthrough, actually, of the Spider chain. You don't need more security at stake than what's actually in the bridge, because you split this up into this network of multisigs. And that's where you get the multiplicator and the breakthrough of the Spider chain. So yeah, right now it would be around like 5 Bitcoin, which, yeah, of course, is already a big quantity.
Yep. And so it's a proof of stake chain, but when people think about that, they think of tokens, they think of inflation. That's like the benefit. You lock up ETH, you get ETH. I'm assuming in this case, you lock up Bitcoin and you're going to get transaction fees as they pass through the network. Is that the benefit to be a validator?
Correct. You lock up Bitcoin and you get Bitcoin. That comes from the gas fees that are in Bitcoin. So it's actually, in your mental model, think about Ethereum on the base layer. With ultrasound money, theoretically, there should be zero inflation. And so on Botanix, there's also, of course, we cannot create new Bitcoin. So there's zero inflation. But all the transaction fees and the gas fees accrue back to the stakers. And this can be a lot. When you think about Ethereum, I think last year they had $5 billion of gas fees.
Yep, makes sense. And you mentioned earlier something about if there's 100 people who are sampled out of a bigger subset, 1,000 or whatever it is, What's the significance of that? Why is that relevant?
Yeah, basically one single multisig is then randomly a subset of 100 participants out of the 10,000. And so the reason for that is there's multiple reasons for it, but the beauty of it is like you get the scalability. So suddenly now you have this one single multisig, all those 100 participants will basically stake 5 Bitcoin. So theoretically, there is at least 500 Bitcoin at stake in that single multisig, right? Now, if you create hundreds or thousands of these multisigs, your theoretical collateralization massively goes up because you basically multiply the number of multisigs that you have times the amount of stake in a single multisig. And so that can go way beyond than what's on the spider chain. So that's a cool thing. The second cool thing is like if you randomly choose those 100, you basically have zero control on like who's going to be in that subset. And so trying to attack this network becomes almost impossible. If you have 100,000 nodes, you cannot control in which multisig you will be in. And so the amount of things you can do as a participant is actually very limited. So it protects you massively against attacks.
Excellent, excellent. And is that number, so we're using 100 and 1,000 or whatever, but is it some threshold? So is it like 10% of the subset, or like how do you guys pick that number?
That's pure theoretical. Basically, once you go signing for big multisigs, we use Frost. So Frost multisigs, if you go, the signing time to sign such a multisig goes up exponentially in the sense that if you would have a Frost of 1,000 participants, that basically takes you, I don't know, probably like a minute or something. If you take 100, that's probably doable in a few seconds. If you take 10,000, I don't know, that becomes like extremely, extremely hard to do. The more participants you have, the more constantly you need to gossip all different subkeys to each other through all these participants to get up with the final signing key. And so 100 is this nice trade-off in the middle where you can actually be fast enough, but it's also big enough. Because if you make it too small, you run into like liveness risks. Like what if you make a multisig of size 3, for example, and two people are offline, then one. And so at a size 100, you can basically have enough people, or let's maybe think there's a blackout in the world or something, right? Some country gets fully partitioned from like the electricity network, or even a state or something. Like, does your network still continue to operate? I mean, theoretically, a lot of people actually in the Bitcoin space have this golden star of a 1 out of n assumption, right? Theoretically, you can run the spider chain with a 1 out of n assumption. I mean, that's totally possible. The only problem is if one of your nodes goes down, then, I mean, you no longer have that assumption. And so it's often this trade-off between liveness and security. And you can, of course, ignore the liveness part. You can ignore that in theory in your white paper. You cannot ignore that in reality when you're building production protocols.
Right. So you mentioned like the 5 BTC limit and it's open membership so it can grow over time. How often are these multisigs getting spun up? Like, is it rounds? Is it daily? Like how often can the network kind of like evaluate and then grow, or I can join?
Yeah. Initially, we were thinking of every 10 minutes. Now there is a lot of interactivity between spinning up a new multisig. And so the thinking we're right now is basically do that every day or every week. And if you go to every week, that's still extremely secure. What you need to do then is increase the staking size. So you have that same balance that is there. If you spin up a new multisig every week, for example, that basically means you'll have to put your staking size to like maybe 20 Bitcoin or something.
I see. And is the so thinking... Go ahead. Well, I'm thinking in real time, like, as a designer of a protocol, the things that you're watching for, the amount of BTC potentially locked, which is the incentive to to try and game the system, and then how decentralized or how much threshold those both at stake should be. That's the question of how often you guys might think about spinning these up, right?
Yeah. I mean, you want real reliability in the protocol, and if you have every 10 minutes, it basically means every 10 minutes you have to do a signing protocol between these 100, and like the more activities each of these, or async activities, as you call it, the more async activities these nodes will have to do, the more risk of them of like being stuck somewhere in the protocol. And so you need to like, I mean, servers are not ideal operating system. Things go wrong. You can never predict a lot of different things. And so you need to come up with like, what if you start signing a Frost multisig and in the middle of your signing process, you get stuck? Okay, what do you do then, right? And so these are the actual realities you have to face when actually building the protocol, which is different from like the reality on the white paper.
Got it. Okay. And then this is kind of a left turn, but it's cool, something to touch on. When you talked to Shinobi, you mentioned something about generating a random number is actually somewhat difficult in computer science, like a provably random number. And one of the beauty of the things that you guys are doing is you're leveraging Bitcoin in a unique way, because it's just this really giant, heavy random number generator. You're using that to pick the subset of the multisig. So like, explain that a little bit, because I found that super interesting.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's actually in the SpireChain white paper, there's been a few breakthroughs that no one else has come up with. I think this model of like splitting this out over a series of multisigs is quite new. The second one is indeed this random number generator. And also for like the Bitcoin staking, I think before us, you just had the stake chain white paper of Robin that no one actually really continued on. So we had that as well. But to focus on the random number generator. A random number is extremely hard to generate. Go talk to anyone who is designing a cold wallet or even a hot wallet or like Casa. To actually come up with a random number for your private key, it's not easy. And proof of stake protocols massively use random numbers for a bunch of different things, basically also to decide who's going to build the next block. Right, in proof of work, that's easy because everyone does it, and the one with the biggest amount of luck or like most energy basically finds the block the fastest. But in proof of stake protocols, you basically decide, okay, now we need a random number, and that's going to decide who's going to build the next block. And so random numbers are really hard. And actually, in the crypto industry outside of Bitcoin, there's been a bunch of different startups. A lot of different companies have found different ways to create this VRFs or verifiable random functions. Even Chainlink has a big program on that. And we came actually to the realization, like if you look at Bitcoin, what you do is you spend 10 minutes of energy, and all these miners do is they actually flip through random numbers, trying to find a random number that fits the block hash where you're enough trailing zeros, right? And so you are absolutely sure that the number that comes out of it is a random number. That's almost like perfect. And the only thing that a miner can do is what's called a withholding attack. They can choose to say like, oh, this number works. I can get the Bitcoin block reward, but I don't like this random number. So that's the only power that they would have. But beyond that, this number that comes out of the Bitcoin block hash is a provable random number, and it's probably the best random number in the world. I don't think there's any better random number you can generate that's not in some type of way gameable, knowing if you know the hardware, if you know if you're using the weather or if you're using temperature or any other thing. This is probably one of the most one of the best random number generators in the world.
I love it. I love it. It's simple when you hear it, but it's so underutilized. I love the elegance of that. Cool. So one other thing on the decentralized piece, because you have a 5 BTC limit currently, which is a pretty big number. You know, it's at current prices, like 300,000-400,000 maybe. And so for the normie, that's going to be inaccessible. So like it moves into medium-sized entities are going to be securing the network and acting kind of like market makers or something to like get a yield on their Bitcoin. How do you think about that? And I guess second question is, like, do you see pools being a thing? Because pools are a big thing on ETH, like Lido. Do you think we'll see Botanics pools pretty early on so that I can, you know, put in $1,000 and get transaction fees?
100%. I actually think it will probably play out very similar to like Ethereum, where you have pools, which means if you as at home as a normie, you can join one of these pools. You don't have to run the hardware. The pools will do that and you can get part of the yield. Now you can question how decentralized is that? And I think that's a very fair question. I think for a thing that we want to do, a decentralized layer that can run the financial system in the world, that's sufficiently decentralized. And so I do think you will see pools. And I think that you will see that actually very early on. Actually, we will start with 15 different full nodes. So 15 different sequencers or block producers. And most of these are actually going to be pool operators from Ethereum. So very professional organization that know how to do it. And that's basically how we're also in the initial phases are going to scale the network. And so, yeah, you'll have that from the beginning. But I think it's better than having a one single node.
Yep, makes sense. Okay. We covered a lot. I think that's a pretty good baseline on Spider Chain. Is there anything that I missed that we should for sure cover on Spider Chain?
Yeah, I think what a lot of people often forget is what we're doing with the Spider Chain is extremely unique in the world of Layer 2s. I don't think there's a single Layer 2 that is actually fully aiming to be decentralized. It comes at a cost. Like I do think there's a big world for rollups that are very centralized and trustless because they can go to 0.1 second block times. We cannot do that. If you want to be decentralized, you need all these nodes to talk to each other, to gossip messages to each other. You have this peer-to-peer network that is operating, and it comes at a cost of throughput. And so it also has its benefits. But I think people often forget that most of the rollups we actually see are central databases that where you produce hashes on, which generate a ZK proof, which you can then verify to make it more trustless. But it's a very different design spectrum. And I think that's the best way to think about the Spider Chain. We go for that decentralization while others go for like the high throughput trustlessness.
Very cool. Okay, I think we can come back up for air then, away from the Spider Chain. And you just mentioned something that's interesting because I hang on to words and I'm like, do I grok that? Does that not make sense? You mentioned this. I don't understand rollups very well, but you mentioned a centralized sequencer that's trustless. And so the way I hear that is you have like an entity like Coinbase who's sequencing things, but I, as an end user, can force a transaction in, and as long as they're being a good actor, it will get included. Is that the way to think about trustless but centralized sequencing?
More so, how I think about rollups is indeed trustless but centralized. In essence, there's a single party that runs the database, right? Can be Coinbase in the example of Base, actually. They run this backend database. People can send in transactions. You update the database or the state machine. And then you create a ZK proof, or you do it optimistically where you post to the base layer and you can have a challenge period. And so basically what the trustless means, it's trustless not fully trustless, because of course you always take trust assumptions. But basically what I mean by more going trustless is that you trust that these people cannot steal. If they would be able to steal, then you can indeed like submit a challenge on the base protocol, and you can you can enforce that they cannot steal from you. Another way, I think what you were more referring to is the censorship resistance. And so one unfortunate thing of centralized operators is they're not censorship resistant. Like any of the rollups will always be able to censor you. What you can do is you can progress transactions by submitting transactions on the base layer. So transactions get enforced on the second layer. However, you're still censored from using the second layer. Now you have to use the base layer to do something. And so basically you get excluded from a whole economy potentially. And so unfortunately, decentralized actors won't ever have the censorship resistance, but you can still have the more trustlessness that you can trust that they don't steal any money. Does that make sense?
It does.
It's very convoluted and it's very confusing. But yeah, it's different.
The way I hear it. So yeah, the censorship resistance piece is helpful. It sounds like the thing I was getting crossed is like they can't steal because you have your private key. As long as your private key isn't leaked, the way that the cryptography works, they can't steal any funds. So like, you're good there. That's the kind of like trustless piece of it. Going back to what you said earlier, it was like a sideline, but you were like, I don't really think the trustlessness kind of like North Star that everyone's saying is going to yield what we think it's going to yield, which is kind of a fiery comment. But I'm curious, like, how do you think through that when you say that comment?
Yeah. So a lot of people in the industry believe or often have this idea, roll-ups have been sold as like this full endgame. Like it's fully trustless. Anything is possible. And we have unlimited scalability and it comes at zero cost. And that is not the reality. And there's a few things that play into that. I think the censorship resistance is one. That's one obvious cost. I think the less obvious cost, and it's still open to debate, is what I call the bug risk. So what if a bug is found in this immutable rollup? What if you can no longer upgrade the rollup? And to use a Bitcoin comparison, what if you make a ZK verifier in a certain UTXO, right? And now a bug is found in what's behind that UTXO. You can never really change that anymore. And so the only way to do that is kill the whole rollup and move that to something else. But how do you do that? Who decides that? And do they have any powers at that moment to like steal something? And so you always come back to a little bit of consensus. I don't believe a fully trustless layer two is possible without consensus. And so this, the roll-ups, if they find the bug risk, right now how they do it is they are, of course, a multisig. And so they can upgrade the smart contract by using this multisig. And so, I mean, every layer two has a different multisig size, but that's the basic trust assumption. For example, if you have a 6 out of 9, that basically means all you need to steal all the funds on the layer two is a 6 out of 9 multisig. And so you suddenly have this majority assumption. And so longer term, are we actually going to be able to move away from that? Are we actually on Ethereum then, in Ethereum land? Are you actually going to be able to deploy this in a immutable smart contract? Because what if a bug is found? How are you going to do that? Like, that's it. Game over. Everybody loses their funds in like the whole world. There's not a single developer in the world that wants to do that. And it also might not be good as a world where you want to move to. So you kind of want to have that upgradability. And so actually the road that Arbitrum is taking is, I think, where all the different roll-ups are going to eventually. You can say, let's make a vote with all the ARP tokens to like upgrade the smart contract, right? And so now let's say 2/3 of all the ARP tokens can decide, can vote, and now we can upgrade the smart contract. And so you still don't have the trustlessness, because if you can reach 2/3 of all the ARP tokens and like buy a huge amount of ARP tokens, you can suddenly steal a lot of money. And so either way you always look at it or you turn it, there's always this corner or this flip side of a thing you won't be able to solve in the long term. And so that's why I say, like, I don't believe this full trustless North Star is actually achievable from a practical standpoint. Now, another thing that people often say is like, okay, we can introduce like a delay, like a multisig plus a delay. But then you still have a bunch of different attack factors, right? Like, okay, what if actually a bug is found? Then you have a window of that delay that people can abuse it. Or if someone wants to maliciously upgrade, all they need to do is like wait a bit, just hide it long enough and then wait. And so, yeah, There's always this reality that plays into roll-ups. Yeah.
Super interesting. Yeah, you've seen this in small regards on a lot of DeFi projects, where some will have admin keys to upgrade, and others are perfectly immutable. And like when you're playing with millions of dollars, that's like interesting. It sucks if you get hacked, for example. But like you're using the word practical very deliberately, which is like at the lowest level of the stack. If Bitcoin had this kind of bug and it was perfectly immutable, it would be a shit show to the nth degree. Like that would be bad. So.
And that's the benefit of consensus. Like we had that bug in Bitcoin in 2018. Bitcoin Core upgraded, everybody upgraded their node, and boom, it was fixed. If it's immutable, then it's game over.
Got it. Okay, that's super interesting. Okay, well, this has been a fascinating combo. Thank you, Willem. Last question of the day. What are you most hyped about right now? It could be in Bitcoin, it could be what you're building, or just broadly. Like what are you excited about?
I'm actually super excited to actually see this world running on Bitcoin. Like, I want to see the whole world running on Bitcoin actually playing out. You see governments, you see politicians coming in, you see everybody, like this whole group of Bitcoiners, like expand. And I'm very excited that we actually now can start building these applications that we've seen actually on Bitcoin as well. I think Bitcoin is the perfect money ever. And then when I look at Ethereum and DeFi, that is a better, more fairer, more equal financial system in the world, where you have tokens that are 24/7, that are better stocks. You have decentralized exchanges that are better than the stock exchanges, where anyone in the world can buy them, where you can borrow against your Bitcoin. This is slowly starting to look like a world that is that would be incredible to live in. So I'm super excited. Like, I really hope we can bring this to life. And I often say this to my team, like what we're actually building as this decentralized layer 2 can actually power a global financial system with Bitcoin as the money. And that's just massive, or like incredible when you try to think about it. Just drives me every day.
That is a fantastic way to end the show. So happy for what you guys are building. Super interesting. Willem, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Thanks, Jacob.
Thank you for listening this far into the episode. If you found it enjoyable, please do like, subscribe on whatever platform that you're listening on. YouTube does me a huge favor to like and subscribe. Find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain. Show me some love. I reply to every DM. And if you are a Bitcoin builder that is kind of at the forefront of building new use cases, whether it's L1, Lightning, Stacks, Rootstock, Rollups, Ordinals, BRC20, I want to talk to you. So when I'm not doing this podcast, I am the sourcing partner at the Bitcoin Frontier Fund, where we invest in Bitcoin startups at the earliest stages, give you access to whatever you need, whether it's legal, product, fundraising help, as well as capital. So love to talk to you. You can hit me up. Again, find me on Twitter at Jake Blockchain and shoot me a DM. I'll read everything. Love to talk to you guys. Alright, peace. It's gone up. We playing the long game to the black rock chains with the rocks paid off from the blockchain. Going up high octane, so we up in here like pomade. Making big noise, big money, go play with your kid toys. You funny, I'm counting my Bitcoin. We up and we been gone. It's gone. Planned it out and we did this purposefully. Panning out like the kitchen currently. It's like surgery. Way it's earning me. A nurse's salary for cryptocurrency. I'm on a vacay drinking coconuts while wearing polka dots. This ain't no hocus pocus. Listen up and learn. It's gone up.